89 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 28th, 2010. Our guest today is Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, one of the most highly acclaimed independent journalists of our time. So she'll be here for the full hour talking about journalism, the news, what's going on in the world, and taking your questions as well. It should be a wonderful hour. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
When Congress approved the $7.2 billion stimulus package for building out broadband services to unconnected areas of the country, the big telephone and cable companies decided not to participate. But now, after more than 2,200 requests for funding, the first grants are being made available to applicants. And companies, including Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and AT&T, are trying to stop the funds from reaching groups that want to connect Americans stuck on the wrong side of the digital divide. Free Press Program Director Timothy Carr says that despite their rhetoric about serving all communities, the phone and cable companies are really only interested in one thing.
I think the only thing that they truly care about is protecting their market share. When you look at the broadband marketplace in the United States, more than 96% of all residential connections to high-speed internet are controlled either by the phone or a cable company. That is a very powerful market duopoly, which yields billions and billions of dollars in gross profits to companies like AT&T and Comcast.
The big broadband providers have attacked the stimulus program on several fronts.
They've done a lot of different things. They scrambled lawyers to try to defeat the openness, the net neutrality conditions that are a part of the broadband stimulus funding. They've challenged a number of local initiatives to get more people connected. Philadelphia, which is where Comcast is headquartered, is applying for funds to create a better wireless network to connect people in poorer communities. And Comcast has been questioning and challenging that effort. There have been a number of other cases in rural Maine and other parts of the country where they are really trying to drag their heels and stop this stimulus funding from going forward.
The Recovery Act also mandates the Federal Communications Commission to draw up a national broadband plan. The FCC will unveil that plan on March 16th. Carr says instead of obstructing the government efforts towards universal internet access, it's time for the phone and cable companies to work with the FCC to create a plan that provides service to every community.
The FCC has suggested a number of ideas, you know, where they want us to be by the year 2020, and now we need to roll up our sleeves, finish this plan, and then get to work creating a fast, affordable, and open internet for everyone.
For more information, go to savetheinternet.com.
Lydia Chavez teaches journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the managing editor of Mission Local, an online and print newspaper that serves San Francisco's Mission District. The project grew out of the university's Graduate School of Journalism and gives students and faculty the chance to gain valuable skills in multimedia reporting while also providing a unique service to the neighborhood. Chavez is a Mission District resident and says the neighborhood's distinctive characteristics made for the perfect site for hyperlocal reporting.
There's a lot of really interesting experiments. I mean, there are a lot of individual people who are, you know, blogging from different neighborhoods. They're individuals and they're doing interesting things, but they're not doing a huge amount of reporting because it's impossible. And there's a lot of aggregation. You know, I could use 10 reporters in the Mission District and I still wouldn't have enough. To do really good reporting, you need people and it takes time and you need people who are trained.
Mission Local utilizes public-private partnerships to do their work and is seeking to create a model for local journalism that is sustainable. Currently, the project is funded in part by the Ford Foundation and supported by local academic institutions.
I think definitely in any other city with a journalism school should use this model. But I also think they have to get support from the community, and we have to figure out the business side of it. I mean, we can't really even sell ads at Mission Local. We haven't been successful in doing that.
Ultimately, the benefits of the project extend to both students and the community.
These kids are getting fabulous training. No one has ever gotten better training. And the community is getting great coverage.
Find out more about Mission Local at missionlocal.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, in this early spring Sunday afternoon. Our guest today needs no introduction. She is one of the giants of journalism in the United States today. And before I introduce her, I'd just like to read a quote from the foreword of her new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, by Bill Moyers. And Bill Moyers writes, "You can learn more of the truth about Washington and the world from 1 week of Amy Goodman's Democracy Now than from a month of Sunday morning talk shows. Make that a year of Sunday morning talk shows." Amy Goodman, welcome to Media Matters. Hello, Amy. Looks like we're having some difficulty with our connection with Amy. So while we're working on that, and I assume it'll just be a matter of moments until we do get our connection up to speed with Amy, let me say that I want to thank all the listeners last week who attended the first annual live episode of Media Matters, which took place in the Siebel Center on campus. It was really an extraordinary event with John Nichols. Amy, are you there?
I am. Hi.
It's great to have you with
us. Hi, Bob.
And thanks so much for taking time from what I know is one of the most extraordinary schedules in journalism to take an hour out of your Sunday to visit with us. We're deeply flattered and honored here at WILL.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your end. Well, just the book is so important, what you and John did, and I thank you for doing that and for being there doing this continuous look at journalism and how important that is, because it's the way most people, you know, come to understand the world, and we need to ensure that we have honest, independent, nonprofit journalism that not just survives but thrives in this country.
Well, I think that the example that Democracy Now! Has provided is really an extraordinary story, and I think a lot of our listeners now watch it on local television. They listen to it locally on WEFT from 4 to 5 on weekdays, and it's all over the web at democracynow.org. But the history, and I've been there more or less from the beginning and following your career and the career of Democracy Now!, is still an extraordinary story that I think isn't really well understood. Just to give some sense, if you would, you know, what was the origins of Democracy Now!, and then how did you build up what has become an extraordinary network?
Well, it really just started as a community radio show for the second election time of Bill Clinton. And we were going from state to state during the primary of 1996, looking in each state as these primaries were happening, why most people in America don't vote. You know, very interesting. I think people are engaged, but why weren't they engaged? The sense of, well, do you really have a choice? And then as we were bringing out these voices of the grassroots from state to state, and also always bringing a global perspective to it, the election came and went. We thought the show would end. We were on Pacifica Radio, but more people wanted it. And so the show actually started to grow even more after the 1996 election. And we did that for another 5 years. And we, in 2001, actually right around September 11th, the public access TV station in New York, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, asked if they could broadcast our radio show. And we amazingly started on that day on September 11th. And, you know, we were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, very close to the Twin Towers. And we went on as emergency programming at the beginning. And then stations all over the country wanted it. So we would send out by FedEx our VHS, FedEx, because, you know, it was breaking news, so at least it wouldn't be later than a day old.
Mm-hmm.
And more stations took it. Then PBS stations started asking, NPR stations started asking, and then the international aspect of it. I think people are deeply connected to the rest of the world. Either people's families or they themselves come from somewhere else in the world, or we have an intense fascination with the world, and we're very much connected to it by foreign policy, all too often through war. And so we've always reached out abroad, and more stations around the world started to take us. And we developed this cutting-edge technology where we could send broadcast-quality video over the Internet since we couldn't afford to satellite it abroad. So now we air daily in two TV stations in Sweden, in Japan, in Austria, daily on television, and on hundreds of radio stations throughout Latin America and Europe in Spanish, the headlines. And this is just growing. I see this just as the beginning, this daily grassroots global news hour. And we've moved into our new studios, and we were really thrilled that you, Bob, and John got to come to launch your book on Democracy Now! In our new studios, to grace our studios in the first months of operation. And there we have really set up, well, it's the greenest internet TV radio studio in the country, you know, using recycled material, doing all sorts of things with the technology that makes it very green. So we're excited about being a model, but to translate the entire broadcast and television and radio into different languages, to broadcast a different image of who we are and the diversity of who we are to the rest of the world. I think that's what will increase our national security.
Our guest, Amy Goodman, who you've been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open for people with questions or comments for Amy Goodman. The number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Amy, we had Sut Jolly from the University of Massachusetts and the Media Education Foundation on, three or four weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, Sut, what do you do to stay on top of the news? And he says, well, the first thing I have to do every day is watch Democracy Now! That's my mandatory pit stop to be a citizen of the world. So, and I know there are a lot of our listeners that feel the same way. And Amy, when we were in New York, you just alluded to when John and I visited your new studios. I must say, I've been in a lot of television studios, commercial, public, community, the works, and your studios are truly extraordinary. It's really a credit to you and to the team at Democracy Now! And to the viewers and listeners, the commitment to put this institution in place. And really, it's you're poised to go ahead to a even far greater heights than you enjoy today, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it almost brings tears to my eyes every day that I walk in there. It looks out in all four directions on New York. It's truly windows on the world. But beyond that, it is a home for us. It's a home for, and beyond us, the team that makes Democracy Now! Happen every day. But it's a home for independent media. You know, when you walk into a TV studio, say in New York, you know, any of the big networks, it is so plastic, and it is completely... it is a complete fake. I mean, that's the idea.
I guess the term it would be used is corporate.
Yeah, corporate and fake. I mean, everything is an illusion. The colors, the materials that are used. But I think that we have to, you know, the medium is the message. And what we are is what we project. And it is a place where we're going to do this work for many, many decades to come, and it's really important that people are committed to this way of getting out. You know, it's the combination of the content and the technology, an affordable technology that actually enables us to reach out around the world and to reach to people doing that work around the world, because we're constantly soliciting work, video, from people all over and ideas for stories. And the more we broadcast in different countries, the more people want to contribute from those countries. That's media from the grassroots up. That's what the rest of the media sets up a bulwark against any kind of democratic participation. But that's what we are very much open to.
Amy, I remember when you were trying to get carried on various stations early on. I don't think it's as much the case today, but back to 5, 10, 15 years ago, 10 years ago at least. And sometimes you would be hit with the argument that you are simply the left-wing version of what Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity of conservative talk radio. And, you know, I've responded to that on your behalf many times. But I'm wondering, since I know you must hear that periodically, how do you respond when your work is characterized in that manner?
Well, I mean, it is so much the opposite, because it's about inclusion. It's about hearing people speak for themselves. And I think what those shows are about is shutting people down. People being brought on as props to be shut up, to be beaten up. And on Democracy Now!, whatever someone's view, it's to have a debate or a discussion about a key issue. It's not personal. It's about people presenting ideas and having the space. I mean, on these networks, the viewer suffocates because there's no oxygen. There's no real chance to really hash out issues. Tomorrow, for example, one of the pieces we're going to do on Democracy Now!, we're going to look, well, of course, it's all still up in the air because it is, you know, a news show that goes on the air till the last second, but we'll deal with Chile. We're also going to be looking at the issue of depression, the secret history of a modern disease. And you can't do that in 8 seconds. And I think people need to be able to sit back or run around. Maybe they're listening when they're running around. Really hear someone, you know, shatter paradigms. How do we think about an issue? You know, looking at the Olympics, my colleague Aaron Mate, who's from Vancouver, went up during the Olympics, and he's going to be presenting a piece on, well, what happened to Vancouver through the $6 billion, what some might call, ordeal. I mean, we look at the glitz, we look at everything that's shining for 2 weeks and all the Olympic stars, but these are huge corporate extravaganzas, whether we're talking about Salt Lake City or Nagano or Vancouver. What happens to the city before and after? The social services that get cut because they go so deeply in debt. It's always presented as a boon to a city. You know, Obama went to Copenhagen to try to get the Olympics in Chicago, but there was a big group of people in Chicago who were saying, no, no, not here. We cannot afford the Olympics. And we're going to look underneath at the underbelly of Vancouver and see how it's been affected. But we need time to do this, and that's why we're constantly trying to explode the 8-second or 9-second soundbite, because we're never going to change things. And I think across the political spectrum, people don't think things are working. Unless we give people a chance to really lay out what is a different vision, whatever that vision might be. And that takes more than this, what I would say is a very political soundbite. When you have 8 seconds, you can only reinforce the status quo, because what can you say in that amount of time than something that everyone understands because they keep hearing it before, which is the chatter of the cable networks. You keep hearing the same thing, so you don't need anyone, you know, you just, all you have to say is Obama, or you just say a deficit, and everyone understands what you mean. No, you got to have the time to say, how would we create something else? And that's what we're trying to do on Democracy Now!
I think one of the other elements of that criticism, Amy Goodman, is the idea that you know, conservative talk radio and Fox News specifically, there's a sense that they have a double standard, that the criteria they had for the Bush administration is different from the Obama administration. If the two administrations have the exact same policy, they'd be viewed favorably under a Republican and unfavorably under a Democrat. And then by extension, if you're the opposite of that, you're sort of doing the opposite. Yet, I think that no one who watches your program would say that. And there was one incident in particular that put you on the map for a lot of people, which took place a decade ago when you had an interview with Bill Clinton, which was almost unprecedented in recent American journalism history. And I think demonstrated the idea that you were carrying water for anyone in power is absurd. Can you talk a little bit about that incident?
Well, that was on Election Day 2000. He was still president, right? Al Gore was running to replace him, Gore versus Bush. And, you know, it was a big day. There could be a massive change in the country or not. And we got a call right before the show aired where they said, you know, the White House is online. This is the White House. And I thought they said White Horse, which is a famous tavern in the Village where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. And I said, White Horse, we're going on the air. The music is already swelling. I'm sorry, I have to go. And I said, they said, the president wants to talk to you. I said, the president of a tavern, right, the White Horse Tavern, at 9 in the morning? Anyway, of course, it was, they said, no, the president of the United States. So he did not call in during the show, but right after the show, when the Latino music show was on, and we were going off to have coffee because it would be a long day's journey into the night, we figured, you know, by 1, 2 in the morning, we'd know whether Gore or Bush were president. We got a call from the control room. Oh, my God, the president is on the phone. And there was Gonzalo Brito, my colleague who does a Latino music show, paralyzed in the control room. And I went running in, and the two of us conducted this interview with our producers for about, well, a half an hour. And we asked, well, I started off by saying to President Clinton, you know, a lot of people are not going to go out to vote because they feel that corporations captured both parties. And he really responded to that with heat. And then I asked him about Leonard Peltier, who, by the way, remains in jail today. But he was the first one who was considering granting him clemency, or so it was said, and had never talked publicly on this issue. And he addressed that. And then we asked about many different issues, the Iraq war, the sanctions against that. At that time, it was sanctions against Iraq, that where, what, 500,000 children had died, and Madeleine Albright made that famous comment to Leslie Stowe when she said, was it worth the price? She said, yes. Now Madeleine Albright says it's the one thing she regrets in her time as Secretary of State. But I asked him about the sanctions, and I said the UN Assistant Secretary General is in charge, and Iraq had all said it was genocidal. He said they were wrong. I asked him about racial profiling, and he said Al Gore would do away with it immediately if he became president. I said, but you guys have been in office for 8 years. Why are you making a promise now and not having done it? We asked about the napalming and bombing of Vieques, a big issue at the time, one of the Puerto Rican islands. And I asked him, as you know, at that time, Ralph Nader was running for president, and he was very popular around the country. And I said, what would you say to those who say you made Ralph Nader popular by taking the Democratic Party to the right? He got very angry, and he said something like, I find you hostile, combative, and at times disrespectful. So I said I just had a few more questions to go. Anyway, it was about a half hour. Usually journalists prepare their whole lives for a half hour with the most powerful person on earth. We had absolutely 0 seconds to prepare for this. And the next day, the White House called up and said I would be banned from the White House. And I said, but why? You called me. I didn't call you. And it went on from there. They said that they had said he wanted to talk about getting out the vote, and I had asked 3 questions related to that, but everything else was not related. And I said, really? How many other journalists interviewed? And they said about 40 radio stations. And I said, and they all, I never agreed to any ground rules. It's a sad comment on journalism today. If they agreed only to ask a certain set of questions, and they said he only had a few minutes and you took a half an hour of his time. And I said, well, he's the most powerful person on earth. He could hang up if he wants to. So that was what happened with that interview. But I really felt an awesome responsibility that morning as we were asking questions, that sense of if people had a chance to ask the president a question, what would they ask? And that is our job as journalists. You know, you can take your microphone into the White House, to someone's home that is usually not heard, and you broadcast what people are saying. And we have a very big job here, especially to hold people in power accountable.
Well, what was striking about that incident, too, Amy Goodman, was that it was the president had never really been spoken to them or asked those questions before. And, you know, it might surprise a lot of Americans, but if you were to go to other countries, it's not uncommon to have leading journalists who are quite aggressive with politicians demanding answers on issues and not content to take talking points and just sort of say, thank you, sir, or thank you, ma'am, and leave the room.
You're absolutely right, Bob. I mean, I remember talking to some European journalists, and they said, in America, you treat your They said, you treat your presidents and your politicians like royalty. And that's so true. You know, they're the head of a political party. They're elected president, not with the majority of votes in this country, because most of the time most people don't vote. But we have a tremendous responsibility to hold them accountable. But you see them, you know, on bended knee, these White House news conferences. They're painful, you know, whether during Bush's years. The rare challenge, you know, Helen Thomas, the dean of the White House press corps, was removed from the front row.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, during the Bush years, over and over, she asked about the casualties. Now, how many Iraqis have you killed today? And it's infuriated the administration, but that's her job. And she knows that she's covered 11 presidents.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman. We're live on WILL AM 580. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open. If you have a question or comment for Amy Goodman, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Amy Goodman, of course, the host of Democracy Now!, which can be seen on TV, heard on WEFT here locally from 4 to 5 weekdays. And you can see her new book, which is a collection of her newspaper columns. God knows how you find time to write those, Amy. Breaking the Sound Barrier, with a foreword by Bill Moyers, just published, and a phenomenal read. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Farina, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Hi. Thanks again for your great radio station, and it's always a treat to call into this program, and I'm honored to talk to you, Professor, and Amy Goodman. The optimist says this is the best of all possible worlds. The pessimist says you may be right. For someone who hasn't seen Democracy Now!, how could you, Amy, say something about what makes the show so credible?
Yes.
I record every show, and I just take your word on faith. But for someone who's never seen it, and just one comment quickly, in the understanding of the truth there in about the world, there is some hope against the almost conspiracy of the percentage of rich and powerful elite who benefit from the ruthless, deadly unfairness and inequality of the world. And I can't thank you enough for your program, and thanks for letting me make a question and a comment. Thanks.
Thank you
very much, caller.
Thank you for that comment. First of all, the one thing is I hope you will not just take everything that is said on the program as gospel, because I hope that what we're about is encouraging people to critically think about everything. And it's an hour on television and radio and on the internet at democracynow.org that is grassroots and global, that is, as we say, unembedded, you know, unembedded in the establishment, unembedded in the troops in Afghanistan or in Iraq, independent, investigative, international, bringing out the voices of people all over the world. And I think while we deal with very difficult issues, right, all the time, as you talk about the growing disparity between rich and poor, war, earthquakes, you know, I just came back from Haiti after the earthquake on January 12th. It's the voices that we bring out are people who are doing something about it. And that's why I think people feel great hope afterwards, describing incredibly difficult situations, but with a resilience, a creativity, an energy to make a difference. That's where the hope comes from. On television and on radio in the corporate media, you get these, you know, know-nothing pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. Here you have true experts on these issues, and you can agree or disagree. But I always talk about how when I watch, and I watch lots of TV, how rare it is to have one of those ping moments where it goes, ping, you learn something. Just straight out. I'm not talking about politics, anything. Just, you know, on these political shows, I mean, I'm not talking about a political point of view where you go, oh, I didn't realize that. Try it one day. Just watch. And how rare those moments are. But on Democracy Now!, I mean, when someone is speaking on the show, how often, you know, I just learn something. And it's about providing a forum for people to speak for themselves, not mediated by the pundits, but people describing their own experience. I mean, being in Haiti after the earthquake, and especially now this weekend with the earthquake in Chile, they're talking about maybe 300 people died, and, you know, maybe that number is going to go up. In Haiti, the number is 300,000, larger than the Asian tsunami, right? That struck 9 countries. Here, it's one tiny half-island nation. And to be able to look at Haiti and to bring out the voices of people in Haiti right after the earthquake, you know, they're covered in cement ash. They're clawing at the rubble to try to dig out their grandfather or their baby or their neighbor's mother. And to hear the U.S. and the United Nations saying that before they bring them aid, they have to secure the area. And we're traveling the roads to the epicenter from Port-au-Prince to Carrefour to Laogan, the real epicenter, and thinking, security? I mean, I felt safer in Haiti than I felt in New York City. What these people need is water, shelter, food, land-moving equipment so they could get their loved ones out of the rubble immediately. It's a nation of amputees now because their legs are crushed, their feet, their hands are crushed. That doesn't mean you have to have an amputation. But if you're not treated right away, then that crushed limb will get infected, and that's when people have to have their limbs amputated. And it was so painful. The first night I came in, I was having a little soup. I was there with Sharifa Dokadus, our senior producer, on the kitchen table of a parish house. A little bit of soup. They cleared the table. They laid down a man, and they cut off his foot. And he was lucky because Denver doctors had come in to help. And the generosity of individuals in this country heading down to Haiti was amazing and bringing out their voices, especially Haitian-American doctors and nurses who just raced down to help any way they could. And I think when people heard their voices on the air from Haiti, it inspired others to go because they thought, my God, this is what it means to, you know, live in a global community, and their dedication. But these Denver docs laid this man on a table. They'd brought something unusual from Denver Children's Hospital. They brought anesthesia. It was a nation without anesthesia. These young men and women, old men, girls, babies, women, grandchildren, grandmothers, grandfathers, they were being having their limbs amputated with Motrin or ibuprofen if they were lucky. But to be able to bring that out, also, though, their resiliency, and to talk about the thousands of pounds of aid that was sitting at the airport. And I think, though, that isn't just about showing a desperate situation, which it was, but what we can do about it. And that's our job. The media is so immediate. It's so real. You feel like it's happening down the street from you. And that's a good thing, because then you have to decide what to do about it.
Our guest, Amy Goodman. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Amy Goodman, of course, the host of Democracy Now, or co-host of it, which can be heard locally on WEFT from 4 to 5 weekdays and seen on the web at democracynow.org. Also the author of the new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, with a foreword by Bill Moyers. Let's go back to the phone lines to our next caller, who's also been very patient. New York City, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Hi, Bob and Amy. Bob McChesney and Amy Goodman are two of my most favorite people in the world, so I'm really happy to call in, something I don't normally do. But I had just a couple of questions. First, Amy, I'm curious as to what your estimate is for your viewership in terms of ratings on a, you know, on a daily basis, because when you look at the MSNBCs, the, you know, Olbermans, and even Bill O'Reilly, they measure their audiences in the hundreds of thousands at most. I mean, maybe Bill O'Reilly goes over a million, you know, a million and a half viewers. So you're talking about a country of 200-plus million people here, and so that's a pretty tiny amount. And the second thing is that despite those relatively tiny numbers, all those shows constantly, you know, show clips and reinforce everything that each other says, and yet you'll never see a clip from Democracy Now! Ever shown on any of those shows, even though so much of what you do is so truly compelling and incredible. I find myself all the time having to point out to people, whether it's just to give a couple of examples, you know, the feature you did on StoryCorps was some of the most compelling television you'll see anywhere. And, you know, another was the Gina Six story that I just couldn't believe was not covered anywhere, and it was maybe a couple months later that Bill Maher, of all people, was the only one that had even the, you know, the willingness to mention something like that on TV. And so I'm curious to what you think about that. And my last point, and it's sort of a broader thing that goes to you, Bob, as well, is in terms of the state of our media, and I think of it in so many ways as being similar to what our healthcare debate and what we've been struggling with there. And when Bob points out that, you know, we're so under budgeted in terms of the amount we spend on public media in this country, and that if it were a proper percentage, it would be huge. But the truth is, when you consider everyone's cable bill and their internet bill, we spend as much or more than anyone else in the world. And again, we're in a situation where we spend the most, but we get almost no value for what we spend. And so, you know, I think of C-SPAN, for example. If you ever watch C-SPAN, you hear constantly callers from every political tilt saying, thank God for C-SPAN. Thank God for a program that actually has exposition and real discussion and isn't cut into four-minute segments. So clearly the public is hungry for this in the same way they're hungry for real health care. And the answer seems like we could get it and actually spend less money overall. But, of course, you know, we've got these middlemen that control a sort of monopoly scenario. So if you want to touch on those topics, I would appreciate it. And thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for calling. And, Amy, I'll let you bet first. And maybe some idea of the viewership numbers for the show and how that compares to the cable TV news programs.
I mean, I actually think we can't really we don't have the same kind of Arbitron ratings that others have because they have one network around the country. It's much easier to judge. And we are a patchwork of hundreds, 800 radio and TV stations, many of which do not get monitored the way, don't get the numbers evaluated the way the big networks do. But we do know that we have millions of viewers, I think larger than MSNBC, all over the world. And our website is hit by millions of people. And there you can watch the show, you can listen to the show, you can read the show, and it's all available for free. And other websites can embed it, of course, and then there's iTunes and all that, and we give it away for free. We deeply believe in the public commons, and we have a Creative Commons license for people to use our information. So there are many ways that people watch it that can't even be counted because they're going to other people's websites that have embedded our information. And you're right, they echo each other. They'll play clips of each other. I mean, I do know that producers on the Jon Stewart show, The Daily Show, they listen to Democracy Now! In the morning, certainly the case with Rachel Maddow. You'll often see guests we've had on become their regular stable of guests, and I'm glad about that. I'm glad that we can provide a forum for people who really are experts in their fields. I think of someone like Jeremy Scahill. You know, he started as a Democracy Now! Producer and went on to do his fantastic work investigating Blackwater, which continues to this day, and wrote Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He's on Democracy Now! A lot, but also on Rachel Maddow and on other shows, was on The Daily Show. And it's we're constantly, we don't have that same small stable that others have. We're always reaching out, always trying to peel back the onion to the person closest to the story. And that takes tremendous work. And my colleagues at Democracy Now!, the producers, sometimes you'll see them on the air. A lot of times they're behind the scenes, Shrufa Gokaduce and Anjali Kamet and Aaron Mate and Mike Burke and Nicole Salazar, just fantastic reporters themselves, digging deep to bring us the people closest to the story.
Amy, do you think that if a commercial cable network approached you and said, boy, we see you're getting these great numbers, we've done some research, and you're really bringing in a huge audience that we'd like to attract, and they offered you an hour every night of commercial television with advertising support driving it, do you think you could do your news program in that environment?
Well, I mean, if a network wanted to run the show, that's one thing, and I would highly encourage it. as for taking corporate sponsorship, that we don't do, because we deeply believe in the nonprofit model of, you know, bringing out information that is not brought to us. I mean, you just think about the key issues of the day now and how they are determined by these huge corporate interests, like health insurance, the health insurance industry, big pharma, the drug companies. You look at the whole issue of climate change. We were in Copenhagen for 2 weeks covering the big climate change summit, the only American broadcast to broadcast a daily hour, just showing where our priorities are. and bringing out the voices of people all over the world who see climate change as a key issue of the day, and the intelligence and the creativity and the diversity of those voices was just amazing, and I think it blew everyone away. But, you know, the oil companies, the gas companies, the coal companies were not brought to them the audience by them. And I think that makes a huge difference. The weapons manufacturers were not brought to you by that. And that's why that listener said, you know, there's a kind of authenticity that we don't get other places.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman, you've just been listening to. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, WILL AM 580. Our phone number, if anyone wants to call in with a question or comment for Amy Goodman, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, also author of Breaking the Sound Barrier, a new book that has just come out. I just want to say to that last caller, the framing he gave about journalism issues and comparing it to healthcare, I thought was outstanding, and I'm going to steal that, and I'll credit him, although I don't know his name, for the idea, because I thought it was very good. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line three. Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Ms. Goodman, just to clarify, are you the person who was violently arrested in 2008 at the Republican convention in St. Paul?
I am.
What? How did that finally end?
Well, it wasn't just me. It was my colleague, Sharif Abdelkaddous, and Nicole Salazar, two producers of Democracy Now!, and for people who didn't know, it was September 1st. It was the first day of the Republican convention. And we were covering the peace protests outside. They continued to cover these protests. I went inside to the convention floor to interview delegates, and I got a call from one of our producers saying that Nicole and Sharif had been violently arrested. They were hurt, and I raced down to 7th and Jackson, where they said that they were, and I demanded to speak to a supervisor, saying that, you know, they could see I was an accredited journalist. I had my credentials on, and that they needed to be released immediately. And they ripped me through that line within seconds. They handcuffed me, pushed me to the ground. I demanded still to see my colleagues. I could only see across the parking lot Sharif, who was bleeding and handcuffed. They brought me to him, and as we loudly proclaimed, we are journalists, you must release us now, a Secret Service officer came over and ripped the credentials from around our necks. And then when I was put into the police wagon to be taken off to jail, there was Nicole. I was charged with misdemeanor, interfering with a peace officer, if only there was a peace officer there, and my colleagues were facing felony riot charges. Ultimately, they were not charged, but they were brought to jail. They were held for hours. I was brought to the police garage and charged, and ultimately I was released. And it was because so many people, hundreds, I don't know, thousands of people, heard about it because it was posted, the video of our arrest was posted on YouTube, and it was the most watched YouTube video for the first 2 days of the convention. It was amazing what it meant for that to go viral. And that's what freed us. And
any apologies?
No, they did not apologize. In fact, they said they would be analyzing the situation quickly and that they would drop charges. It took them weeks to drop the charges. In fact, on the last night of the convention, when John McCain was just speaking, Sharif was arrested again, among many other journalists as well. You know, more than 40 journalists were arrested in that week. And it's unacceptable. We should not have to get a record when we put things on the record. And it's not just a violation of our freedom of the press. It's a violation of your right to know. Because if journalists are chilled, if they're detained, if they're beaten, if they're arrested, it's going to be harder for you to get information. It's going to be harder for you to find out what's happening in the world. And that is a real threat to a democratic society.
Thank you very much, caller. Amy Goodman, our guest here on Media Matters. Amy, one of the issues, the War and Peace Report is the subtitle of Democracy Now!, one of the issues you have probably covered at Democracy Now! As well as anyone or better than anyone has been the U.S. wars of the past decade in Iraq and now and as well as Afghanistan. And if you could generalize, because you say you watch a lot of the other U.S. news media, What are the main flaws of the coverage generally that the rest of the news media, or much of the rest of the news media, are giving us with regard to Iraq and now Afghanistan that you try to compensate for or overcome in your coverage on Democracy Now?
Well, definitely bringing out people at the target end of the U.S. military machine. I mean, how rarely we hear Afghanis speaking, how rarely we hear Iraqis speaking, and also soldiers. There is a number the Pentagon doesn't like to talk about, which are the thousands of soldiers who've said no to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, refusing to go. They keep the numbers, but they don't like to talk about those numbers. And then the level of trauma that these wars have created, certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan, but among the men and women who have fought, you know, more than a million altogether so far. And it's believed that more than a third of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is so serious. I mean, when you think of the number of suicides, of soldiers coming home, they don't even count in the war dead. When a soldier dies, President Obama writes a condolence letter to the family. He does not write a condolence letter to the families of those who've committed suicide. But think of the ripple effect as well of soldiers who come home who are feeling this terrible violence inside, do not know how to deal with it. I think that's post-traumatic stress disorder. The ripple effect it has in their families, domestic violence, and out into the broader community. These are the stories that don't get told. And I think that, you know, Vietnam, there were hundreds of underground newspapers, there were resistance, there was a resistance movement. But it has reached a peak now with the number of soldiers who are critical of why we've been in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those voices need to be heard. A movement has grown up among them, military families who are opposed to the war, Iraq veterans opposed to war, that's IVAW, and these are very, very important voices that need to be heard.
Amy, a few weeks ago, maybe it was a couple of months ago, John McCain was on one of the Sunday morning interview programs, and he was asked about Obama's foreign policy. And this was just in the period when Obama was announcing the huge increase in the offensive in Afghanistan. And I'm paraphrasing, but Senator McCain basically said that what President Obama had done in Iraq and Afghanistan is pretty much identical to what he would have done were he elected president. And I'm wondering, as you have been studying U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 14 months, have you seen a discernible difference in the Obama approach to that of the predecessor Bush administration?
I mean, that's a very good question. If the policy would have been different in Iraq and Afghanistan, the rhetoric is different, but escalating the war in Afghanistan, you know, this is very serious. This is now Obama's war. And the real question is, you know, this the answer? In Breaking the Sound Barrier, the book of columns I do, and by the way, just a comment on that, when you ask about, you know, going into the mainstream media, that's what Breaking the Sound Barrier is all about. That's the name of every column. And I do it for King Features, which is Hearst. And the idea of it over these last years was to reach into the mainstream media, to get the column out there, to provide a kind of roadmap for readers who wouldn't go right away to independent media, but who open their newspaper for those newspapers that are surviving, go to different websites. And they see these sort of arrows in the road that point to a different universe, and that's why I do it. But in column after column, I take on this issue of war, for now Obama's war, because I think that the movements that elected him, that while he's been consistent, you know, he said he was going to intensify the war in Afghanistan, and he did, but I don't think people really heard that. Because of his opposition to the war in Iraq, that's what the anti-war movement latched onto, and I think they're caught off guard now. The millions of people who elected him are kind of off balance, trying to figure out what to do. They don't want to undermine the person they elected. On the other hand, the policies that he is pushing forward are exactly why they were galvanized to vote out the previous administration. And they have to figure out what to do now when the community organizer in chief has become the commander in chief, and he is pushing war like the previous one.
Our guest, Amy Goodman. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. We have time for another call or two if you want to call in at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to another call right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Yes, as longtime fans of both Amy and Bob, I'm very curious to know what both of you, how both of you feel about the movement, seeming movement towards corporate fascism. Those are heated words, but given Obama's seeming ineffectiveness with the corporatocracy, and I've followed you, Bob, over the years trying to maintain net neutrality. How do both of you feel about, let me rephrase the question, what are the signs that we need to watch out for as we move in that direction, if indeed that's where you think we're going?
Amy?
I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, caller. Amy Goodman?
Well, Bob, why don't you take it first? Also, by the way, I wanted to hear what you said about the amount of money that goes into public broadcasting in the United States versus other countries.
Well, just the statistic there, and we've got it in the back of the book, is roughly $400 million federal money for public and community broadcasting as well. And in most other nations in the world, on a per capita basis, the spending in most other democracies is anywhere from 20 to 75 times that. I mean, we're just a speck of sand on the beach compared to most democracies. And the figures are in the book that John Nichols and I wrote that we shamelessly flogged during Pledge Drive here for listeners interested. We'll be back with that in a few weeks. But why don't you take a crack at that, Amy, because I know this is a story you've been covering.
Rephrase the question.
Well, just the sort of the growth of corporate power, and I think the caller is alluding to some extent to the Citizens United case of a few weeks ago.
Oh, I mean, this decision that's been made to open the floodgates even wider to corporate money flooding politics is frightening. And, you know, I think this takes a people's movement to really decide where we want to go in this country. As we watch the health care debate, don't think it's not these corporations that are driving all of this. I mean, every time they emphasized the bipartisan summit, right, that was taking place at Blair House on Thursday that President Obama presided over, it was supposed to suggest bipartisan, somehow is supposed to suggest, I guess, you know, it covers all of the different points of view. I mean, it covers a big, broad corporate point of view.
Or how about the term moderate, Amy? Someone's a moderate, which is always held in high regard, but it usually means they're on someone's pay.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, the single-payer advocates, which when polls are done show most people are for that in this country, Medicare for all, were excluded from the discussion. They couldn't be a part of it. And Obama has tried to make sure of this from the beginning, which is very surprising considering if he was for the public option, which he clearly isn't, you would have kept single payer on the table and say, see, I'm not going to go that far. I'm for the public option. But by taking that off right away, public option looks like it's the most extreme example. But, you know, we need to be able to conduct affairs in this country not determined by the most powerful corporations. They are not people, they are not communities, and we got to take our country back. And I think it's very important to have non-corporate media that challenges that. Yes, the corporate media should too, but they're wholly owned subsidiaries. We've got to really do this and rededicate ourselves as independent journalists to taking on the powers that be.
Well, I just want to underline that my response to that question invariably is pretty much that one. I'm interested in media, but it seems that in democratic theory, in our own history and looking at other nations, the solution to concentrated power, corporate and governmental, is a diverse, rich, critical, independent news media. And you don't get anywhere without that. Let's go back to the phone lines now for what will probably be our final caller. Line two, Chicago, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
And the way you're covering so much, about my question, the book Ralph Nader recommended was The Tyranny of the Two-Party System. And certainly we see how closed off they are, especially with campaign contributions limiting anyone's access and so forth. But in a way, could you comment somewhat about the extra need for an independent People's Party, whatever you want to call it.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Amy Goodman, third parties?
One thing I would just say is that the media's got to open up to a broader spectrum than the two corporate parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. It's a serious responsibility we have. It's not just a bipartisan country. That's one small spectrum of the issues that people care about and debated there. It, you know, I think most of America is outside of the spectrum in Washington, and we have responsibility to bring out the voices of candidates from more than the Democratic and Republican parties.
You know, we've only got a few minutes left, Amy, and I'm just wondering, as you look at what's being covered and discussed in our mainstream news media, if you could say there are one or two or three issues or subjects that are really not there at all, just not being covered, that really ought to be there, that you think are really important, what would they be?
Well, I mean, I think the big issues are not covered. You know, when you talk about war, hearing the voices of the targets of war, as opposed to just talking, you know, with the generals. And by the way, they're the pro-war generals, because those like General Batiste from the great upper New York, Syracuse, Rochester, who began speaking out against the war, he suddenly is not interviewed by the media anymore. So it's military men and women with a particular perspective. I think war. I think those in this country who are suffering from the lack of health care, not just the Democrats and Republicans in Washington who couldn't have better health care system. You know, the Republicans who want to ensure that, you know, those who don't have health care, that this system continues. I think we need to hear from people who don't have health insurance or who are struggling with the health insurance that they have. Education, we really need a bottom-up look at what's happening with the schools in this country. And on the issue of climate change, it's almost not covered at all, yet weather is covered every single day, 100 times a day on the networks, you know, telling us what the temperature is, where the snowstorm will be, whether it will rain or not. We need a lower third, you know, a little caption as they speak that continually talks about, they say extreme weather. The words they should be flashing are global warming. And when we start making those connections, I think it'll change everything that we do, how we conduct policy, foreign and domestic, in this country.
Amy Goodman, our guest. I'm Bob McChesney. We've only got a minute or two left. And to close, Amy, you know, I've been traveling the United States with John Nichols for the last 4 or 5 weeks, all over the country, giving talks about the new book we've written. And I know you travel more than anyone I know. You do your show not only all over the United States, but all over the world. And you probably see as many people and talk to as many people as anyone I know, certainly any journalist. And, you know, one of the things that has struck me and John during our last 5 or 6 weeks, traveling around, has been how demoralized so many people are and despondent. And I'm an optimist by nature. In fact, I am an optimist, and I know you are. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing, and I'm just wondering, what do you say to people who say, why aren't you completely depressed and given up because it's hopeless?
Because I am inspired by people who are doing things all over who don't give up. I mean, coming from Haiti, to see people at the grassroots level helping each other when they had almost nothing, looking at how people are working in their own communities to protect each other in this country and around the world. That's what inspires me. People in their communities are working hard, and I think it's very important to link up these voices in this country and around the world. We are a global community, and we need a truly global media from the grassroots up.
On that note, Amy, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Amy Goodman, our guest today, Media Matters, author of Breaking the Sound Barrier of Democracy Now!, as always, a great honor to have
Thanks
you with
so
us.
Thanks so much, Bob.
And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for engineering today. Melissa Trentz, as always, for producing. And we'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Today, mostly cloudy skies with a high of 38. Monday night, a chance of flurries with a low of 25. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high of 38. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.